listening to Regen 360 with your host, David Gottfried. We're here to inspire visionaries to dream bigger, climb higher, and never give up. You'll hear dynamic interviews from top experts and gurus in sustainability, health, and technology. Now welcome your host, David Gottfried.
So, Dr. Paul, great to have you here today. I'm excited. Believe it or not, it's huge to talk about addiction, and I'm excited to talk about it because, as you wrote the book and point out, this is an enormous problem hitting all of us and our families. So, thanks for being here for Regen 360.
Thanks, David, for having me on your show.
So you have your new book that came out, The Addiction Spectrum. I encourage all readers to get it. Dr. Paul has spent a career in this field and also has family and personal experience. This is his passion. It said the clinic in the book that helped over 13,000 people, but I think with the book, you're going to hit hundreds of thousands.
Well, we hope to make a dent in it anyway. As you know, people are really suffering out there.
And I want to start, you've got this part that I highlighted in the beginning of your book, and you also tell your personal story of addiction and that you have 9 kids, and it's hit 5 of your kids and your wife, and it's hit all of us. But you write, I'll put it bluntly, I wrote this book because I don't want you to die. I don't want addiction to ruin your life. Let's talk to that. To the audience, and why you wrote that, and what you mean, and why this book.
Right. Well, in my addiction clinic, David, I am dealing mostly with opiate addicts. And just yesterday, I was talking to a 25-year-old young lady who's now got a couple years with me and is doing very, very well. She had a story of being, you know, homeless and on heroin. And we were just talking a little bit about the statistics about how poorly people are doing out there. You know, we've got 45 million Americans are addicts or alcoholics. Half of those people are in recovery. But the death toll, especially from opiates, is just skyrocketing. I mean, just 30,000 overdose deaths alone this past year just from fentanyl. And that's not speaking of the heroin deaths, et cetera. And so I asked her, I said, are you feeling this at all within your community? Because she's been on the street, right? And she said, oh, yeah, just in the last few months, I've lost 2 of my friends. 2 young friends of one of my patients overdosed and died from opiates right here in Portland, Oregon. And this is happening across the country. The statistics are horrendous. And I don't want you, if you're listening to this show, to have this happen to you personally, if you're struggling with addiction, or to a family member or a loved one. And so I wrote this book to sort of hopefully get our attention and also give you some tools to help you figure out where do you begin? What do you do? And there's no one answer for one person, right? This is a journey for each of us, but we need help. You know, people are struggling out there.
So this hits home for all of us. We all have our stories, and maybe some of the listeners, it's personal, and it's yourself. Maybe it's yourself, and you don't want to admit you're an addict. You have prescription drugs, and that might be a back door. Some of it, it's our siblings or they're our good friends. Let's talk about, you have an addiction quiz in the book, and maybe some of us are deceiving ourselves. Let's speak to those folks about who's an addict, who isn't. And then I want to get much deeper here on the addiction and the recovery for sure.
Well, first of all, let me qualify this by saying that, you know, we each have to come to our own understanding for ourselves of whether or not we are in trouble with regards to our substance or substances that we might be starting to abuse or overuse. I wrote the book and titled it The Addiction Spectrum because it's really my observation that none of us is just born, unless your mother happened to be hooked on opiates or alcohol, for example. We're not born addicted. Most children are healthy, happy, vibrant, lots of energy, no addiction issues. And somewhere along the line, usually it's in adolescence, we start overdoing something. So whether it's, I've got a whole chapter on screens. So there is screen addictions, which we can talk about later.
Yeah, that's actually important.
It's important and it's big, and people don't realize the magnitude of the health impact you can have from a screen addiction. I'll tell a story later about that. But, you know, my own story, for example, with alcohol, I was a missionary kid in Africa, went to a boarding school on a mountain in Swaziland. I had zero opportunity, almost zero, to do any drugs or alcohol. I mean, I was very, very sheltered and protected. So here I was, a sitting time bomb as far as vulnerabilities, right? I have some genetic risk factors, clearly. I now know what some of those are. But at the time, I just had a golden childhood. Come to the United States for college, discover alcohol, and went, for me personally, when I drank, it was like, ah, that's better, right? It just did something for me. Unbeknownst to me, I had an underlying level of anxiety that was fairly high. I just lived with it. To me, it was normal. So when I had that first high, enough alcohol to feel it, it was an amazing feeling. I think I chased that feeling for much of my adult life. And this is a misconception people have about addiction. Your substance of choice that you might become addicted to was actually your solution at some time for something. That's why you did it. It relieved anxiety. It relieved stress. It helped you cope. It had an actual purpose that was helpful at some point. But unfortunately, with addictive substances, as you become more and more addicted and you move along the addiction spectrum, as I put it, you can reach a point of no return, so to speak, where you find yourself unable to stop. And so that's, you know, the first thing for somebody who might be struggling is developing an awareness that, whoa, I might have a problem here. So what was once just an experimental, once in a while solution to some stress or anxiety now becomes a habit. And then the habit becomes an obsession. And then that obsession starts, you start to experience physical withdrawal, anxiety. Depending on your substance that you're addicted to, your withdrawal symptoms might be different, right? If you're withdrawing from alcohol or opiates or meth, it's a slightly different symptom, or even from screens. But nonetheless, you feel worse when you don't have your addictive substance or your addictive behavior, and so you go back to it. And now you're just taking your substance to relieve the symptoms of withdrawal rather than how it was once before, where it was just helping you cope with something. And that's that vicious cycle of addiction.
And the spectrum that starts with just, hey, it, like you said, it feels better. I don't even know I have anxiety, but when I drink, I feel calmer.
Right.
It self-regulates that anxiety. Let's talk about the brain. What's going on in the brain? So before you had your first drink, you had anxiety, you weren't aware. What's going on with the brain then? And then when you take the alcohol or other addictive practices, what's going on? Is it playing with dopamine? Something's going on that creates that calming feeling. And then let's talk about the brain and what happens with the addiction.
So, you know, we have neurotransmitters. Dopamine is the most well studied and understood when it comes to addiction. One of Marv Sepla, the CMO of Hazelden Betty Ford, used to give a talk. I think he still might. My dopamine made me do it. And you know, there's some debate about whether that's a correct statement or not. But nevertheless, there's no question. Almost every addictive substance or behavior boosts your dopamine. And when you boost dopamine, you get a bit of euphoria. And you just feel better. Dopamine is also a focus molecule. So people with ADD, ADHD who have trouble with focusing and staying on task, with a little extra dopamine, you can stay on task. So the meth addicts, for example, they can take care of all their responsibilities for a while until they've, you know, totally destroyed the ability for that system to recover, right? So with the brain neurotransmitters, a little tiny stimulus feels good. A frequent tiny stimulus can eventually harm you, and that's what happens with screen addictions, for example. Or a massive stimulus, take methamphetamine, you're going to deplete the dopamine that's there to the point where there's none left. And then you feel so horrible you don't know if you can survive. And so you'll hear addiction, folks who are in the midst of addiction speak of getting to that jumping off place, reaching a point of such despair that it feels like it's not even worth living anymore. They're dopamine depleted, if you want to just focus on that one neurotransmitter. Of course, there are others.
Right. Well, if you're dopamine depleted, how long does it take the body to resupply? And how long that grief period?
Yeah. So it depends on the substance and the extent to which you've depleted it. So for example, I'll talk about screens just as a milder example of something that can still deplete your dopamine. I had a 16-year-old patient a few months ago who came in suicidal, flat affect, completely depressed, like one of the more severe depressed kids I've seen in a while. Mm. She couldn't focus. She had no energy to even get out of bed and go to school. This was a young lady I had known since she was a baby. She came from a great family. She was a great student, a student athlete, and she was in trouble emotionally, physically, in every way possible. Long story short, I made a few adjustments to her, dealt with her suicidal ideas, you know, all of that, but said, let's see you back here in a month. She came back and looked 100% normal. Like in 30 days, she had gone from suicidal, I don't know if I can live, to I feel great. And I mean, she was animated. She was happy. I said, what the heck happened?
Yeah.
What changed? Because I've never seen such a dramatic thing. I don't know. You adjusted my meds a little bit. I'm going, no. I've been doing this for 30 years. A minor adjustment in meds does not turn you from catatonic, depressed, suicidal to perfect. Well, what had happened was shortly after she left my office, she had a concussion. She was at soccer practice and had a really bad head concussion. She was put on 100% brain rest. No school, no telephone, no TV, no friends, no reading, rest. And her brain healed. So that answers the question for cell phone addiction. It turns out she was spending 7 to 8 hours a day on school days on her cell phone and almost continuous on the weekends. And that tiny little total bleep, bleep, bleep of dopamine where you're just constantly stimulating had finally gotten her so depleted that she was in that kind of trouble. In a month, she had completely healed. Now, I'll answer the same question for my opiate addicts. It's a different story. So if you've had high dose heroin use for years and then you want to detox. So in the old days, we used to do cold turkey detox. You would go into an inpatient treatment center and you would just be weaned off very quickly in a matter of a few days. And you would stay there for a month because you felt so horrible. Now with that withdrawal from opiates, when you've been at a high dose, you're like hanging on by your fingertips. You're so anxious. So low energy, the craving to try to relieve that anxiety and that angst that you feel is so intense that most people would leave the treatment center and go straight for their drug. And we had such a high relapse rate from people who would be detoxed and then sent out after a month because that system, it's not enough time to heal. Mm-hmm. So what I've done in my practice for the opiate addicts is I use a medication called buprenorphine. And it's a partial opiate, but it's a very strong blocker also of the opiate receptors. And then we very slowly lower their dose. I used to wean people in 3 to 6 months, and they would do the same darn thing that used to happen when people left inpatient. They'd relapse. You wean too fast, and that dopamine system has not recovered, and they would go out and relapse. So now we wean patients over 2-3 years sometimes. Very slowly lowering the dose, allowing the brain to heal while you're doing some of the things that I talk about in my book. So this is the other piece of healing from addictions. Most of us are not eating well. We're not getting all our nutrients. Most people are vitamin D deficient. B12 is a problem for a lot of people. B6, methylfolate, and stress. Stress is a huge factor in trying to heal from addiction. Then there's getting enough sleep. If you're not getting restorative sleep, just try pulling a bunch of all-nighters and see how you do, right? You're a mess. And then there's having a safe, nurturing environment. That piece, I think, is underappreciated in our society. The fact that we need to live in a healthy community of supportive people. I have the example in my book of the rat park experiments that were done in the 80s. I share those with your listeners?
Yeah, please.
It was brilliant. So the scientists in Canada took isolated rats and gave them the choice between, they had the option to drink morphine water or water. And the isolated rat would drink morphine until it died. They take those same rats and put them in a rat park. So this is a huge cage that has places to play and mate and hide and toys. And they would totally ignore the morphine and just drink water. You could even take a morphine addicted rat, put it in the rat park, and it would rather go through the withdrawal so it could have social interactions with all the other rats and be a part of that wonderful community. Humans are no different. If we take ourselves and we isolate ourselves and then we add stress to our lives and we deplete our nutrients, we sleep deprive us, we're going to look for relief, right? And if that relief is alcohol or marijuana or opiates, meth, whatever it is that boosts our dopamine, we're probably going to do it because we're so anxious and angst. So that's the importance of community.
So some of that community is built into these 12-step programs.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the beauty of 12-step programs, or if it's smart recovery or other sorts of group therapy type communities, is that you found your tribe. So those of us who've struggled with addictions often start feeling very isolated, or we just isolate because we're in shame. You know, I didn't grow up thinking I can't wait to grow up and be an alcoholic, right? I mean, as a young kid, you asked me what I was going to do. I was going to be a minister, a preacher like my dad. Or then I realized, no, I couldn't do that. That'd be hypocritical because I liked girls. So I decided, okay, I'll be a doctor. I never thought, well, when I grow up, I want to be an alcoholic. You know, that's just not on our radar. It's something we want. So when we find ourselves kind of stuck in an addiction, there's a lot of shame involved. And part of what I'm also trying to do with this book and just being open about my own journey and my family's and is we've got to throw this shame aside. Addiction is a physical, chemical issue, and nobody chooses it. Sure, you made the choice to put that first beer in my mouth, right? But here's the thing. There's so many stories in my clinic of patients who had a major motor vehicle accident or trauma, and they were put on opiates for pain, legitimate prescriptions for pain. And by the time they were ready to try to get off those pain meds, they were physically addicted. And so then they don't know how to get off those pain meds. And unfortunately, right. we have a society where opiates are easy to get.
They didn't choose that path. They needed it for the pain. But right. Then something's going on with their biochemistry and their brain that they cross over that spectrum. They advance, right?
Exactly. So you've moved
even with good intentions and the strong will, you still get addicted, right?
Exactly. And so that's that misconception that is, you just have no willpower. I mean, I am a very successful physician and author, and I mean, anything I put my mind to in my life, I've been able to accomplish, but I couldn't stop drinking, right? What the heck is that about? So it's not exactly a simple willpower issue. It's a lot more complicated than that.
Well, and it's people look at you and say, just stop. And it could be sugar, this sugar addiction and carbs and yeah.
Thank you for that example. I love that example because anybody who's judging someone else about their weakness with their addiction, since 2/3 of us are either overweight or obese,
yeah.
Well, what about those 2/3 of us, right? Can't you just eat right? What's wrong with you?
Yeah, like right? Stop it.
Yeah.
You're at the coffee shop and Dr. Sarah calls it the glass coffin is staring you in the face. And they even are trained to say, you know, would you like a muffin or croissant with your with your caffeine?
Exactly. So honestly, 2/3 of us are at least addicted to processed foods, highly refined foods, sugar. We're all somewhere on the spectrum for something. I mean, there are those, I suppose, rare saints who eat perfect, live perfect, love everybody perfect, don't judge anyone. But the 99.9%, the rest of us, there's always things we can do, right, to improve our lives.
Even those, you know, Robin Williams and Anthony Bourdain seen that. Yeah. We love them. We miss them. And they killed themselves. Yeah. And I bet you that's brain, and maybe there is addiction there too.
Oh, absolutely. They were both addicted. And you know, we know more now that's about some of their addictions, but yeah, that one really hit hard. I mean, I love Robin Williams so much. And then, you know, he was actually in a treatment center here in Oregon. So he was battling that same addiction issue. And Anthony Bourdain, I remember the week he passed watching one of his shows and turning to my wife and saying, doesn't he have the best job in the world?
I know.
And next that week he passed, he dies. Oh my Lord. And what's, you know, so the external appearances that we put on, right, that look good, it may not be all as it seems. You know, a lot of people are struggling.
We have to hit that because, you know, you go to the conference, you're a doctor. I was a green building guy. We run a health company. You see 100 colleagues. You got your New York Times bestseller. They say, how are you? You know, and you say, yeah. I'm great. My book came out. It's pubbing on my next one. I got the advance. A lot of people always just say I'm busy. You know, well, what does busy mean? I'm successful. My ego's happy. Feed my ego. Yeah. Kiss my feet. Yeah. You know what? There's the Robin and the Anthony's and millions of others. The real answer, I'm depressed. I'm an addict. I hide it. I'm ashamed. I can't get up in the morning. I sneak alcohol. I sit in my car at lunch and cry. Who the hell ever tells you that? And why? Why do we hide?
Well, David, I think we've isolated ourselves as a society. So where I grew up in Africa in a village the first few years of my young life, it really was a community. And you couldn't walk by someone's house without being invited in for a meal. So nobody would ever go hungry. Nobody would ever sit alone for a meal. That sort of sense of community that I think maybe 50, 60 years ago, some smaller towns in America had that same feel. We've lost it with all of our modern advances in technology. And even though people might be more connected in the sense of online connectedness, it's different. There's something about sitting together. I'll tell people, you know, look off in the distance at the forest. And what does that feel like? Now look at your cell phone. It's a different experience. And the forest is soothing. The cell phone, the screen is stressful. Human beings are animal kingdom creatures. We're wired to scan for danger. And unfortunately, all around us is a danger signal. If you watch the news, it's danger. If your alert goes off on your phone, that's a danger signal. It might be a teeny one, but it's danger, danger, danger all day long. And our neurotransmitters are just not keeping up.
You know, you opened a door. We could probably talk for, 10 hours here, but I'm a green building guy by profession. But I just believe our survival wiring, which is hot amygdala, which is, you know, danger, tiger, the tiger's coming, or we're going to run out of food, or we're going to freeze. If I don't kill that thing, we starve. But our survival wiring has not evolved. You know, I can go to Whole Foods. I can lock my front door. I can turn on the heater. And yet, ping, 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 ping. And now the phone is the tiger.
Right.
I know we have plasticity the last 20, 30 years, but we're just not evolving with the new neural network to create survival wiring to actually survive.
Right. Well, the demands we're putting on the system are just too much, right? I mean, it's too much to expect that you can't evolve that quickly. The change is happening so rapidly in the last 200 years. There aren't enough generations for mutations to take hold and to be able to change the wiring to adapt to this level of stress. And so we're going to have to be intentional about giving our body the nutrients it needs, protecting ourselves from stress. And the biggest one besides crap food, and the biggest one is all these screens and all this connectedness that's not physiologically, it's overwhelming our systems. It really is.
Glad you brought it up. And I'm getting nervous because I've got two kids and their friends come over, they're eating a meal, their phone, they're eating their meal with their phones, they're interacting with their friends through the phone, and sitting across the table. Yeah, or we'll go to a place and they're looking at Snap Map and there's like 22 friends surrounding us at the Brandy Melrose store.
Yeah.
And she's like, I know them. I said, well, let's go say hi. But they don't even know that they never said hello.
Right. So 3 years ago, it was Father's Day. I was sitting at home and I noticed that I was on my lazy boy in the living room. And four or five of my adult children, you know, late teens, early adulthood, were sitting in the same room on their cell phones. So I thought as an experiment, I'll just sit here and see how long it takes for them to wake up and say something to dad, right? This is Father's Day after all. Never happened. I wished I could have had the patience to wait long enough because I finally said, guys, put your phones away. So this past Father's Day, I had an experiment. I told all my kids, I sent them a text message because they'll see a text message. They may not answer the phone, but they'll see a text message. I texted them. I said, it's Father's Day. I'm cooking a wonderful, huge brunch. You are all welcome. One condition, no cell phones today. You can put it on airplane mode or leave it at home. I have one child who called up and says, I need to be on my phone for work. And it was an excuse. I said, well, that's too bad. Then you're not going to be able to come. But I love you anyway. And, you know, good luck with your work. And I found out later that was really an excuse. He could have come. Everybody else left their phones in their pockets on off or airplane mode. At the end of the day, we had the most incredible day together. Every single kid stuck around there going, we've never had such a wonderful Father's Day. Because why? We were talking to each other. We had conversations we would have never had if all we were doing was superficial text messages and checking social media.
You know, they probably looked you in the eye. You know,
they don't look us
in the eye.
We sat around in the living room, on the patio, around the dining room table. It was unbelievably amazing how much we connected. And that's not happening very much, especially if we're allowing those phones to be that distraction.
Yeah, we got to deal with all parents and the parents too. We do it as adults, and we think we're more evolved. We think we're more sophisticated, but
yeah, I've read that the app makers in Silicon Valley, for example, they don't let their kids have social media or cell phones because they know they are making these apps specifically to be addictive. Right? They figure it out. What will keep you swiping? What will keep you clicking? What will keep you engaged? And those are built in, and we don't even realize it as consumers that we're actually, you know, we're trapped.
It's bad. I notice myself. I take the dog out in the mornings, my favorite time. We walk on a dirt path and the trees, there's coyotes and deer and squirrels, and there's my phone in my pocket demanding attention. And I don't have the notifications and the pings, but there's a guy I was passing who is every morning he's walking his dog on his phone, staring down. The dog's got the leash. And I noticed today I saw him staring at the phone and I started to reach for my phone because I saw him on his phone.
Yeah. When you see pictures from the news of people on the street and they're all looking at their phones. Yeah, it's quite something.
It's big. So let's talk about recovery. And you have a 13-step method plan in the book. Certainly you've mentioned stress and sleep and balancing dopamine. But talk to us about the three first little steps towards recovery. How does someone who's suffering right now catch themselves? What's the first thing they need to do?
Well, so you need to have a reason to change. So I talk about a laser-focused why, and that's what I put at the beginning of the book, but of those 13 steps. However, or 13 points, I don't want to call it the steps because that there's the 12 steps of all the 12-step programs. But I might actually add this. Here's the challenge. Most of us who start to become aware that maybe we're getting a little too far into our substance, perhaps it's becoming a problem, we don't have the will. We don't have the willingness to even look at it, right? So I would say as you start to develop an awareness that maybe there is a problem with this substance or this behavior, pray for willingness to do it, do something about it. And then once you get that willingness, you can either walk into a 12-step program. You can go, if it's a severe substance addiction, you can walk into an addiction clinic or a treatment center, or read my book and start looking at the options you have to work on things yourself, right? So develop a reason why. It's very interesting because I still go to 12-step meetings myself even now. And what I hear over and over and over again, the thing that gets people to start the journey of recovery is fear. Fear that you're going to die. Fear that you're going to lose your loved ones. Fear that you're going to damage your kids. Some kind of fear. And I have to admit for myself, that was true. I saw my family, and my wife scared the bejeebers out of me. She was going to die of an opiate overdose. I knew I was drinking too much. Couldn't seem to stop. And then I had my kids. I saw I was affecting them. It was starting to be like, this is a bad example here. I'm going to ruin my kids. And I was fearful for my own life because I couldn't control what happened in the evenings. And what if I had to go drive? And what actually instigated my final last straw got me into recovery. I'd promised somebody to go up to the mountain to go skiing, but I was the driver. And we were going to leave late in the afternoon. And I knew I couldn't be sure I wouldn't drink, because that's just how I was at that stage. I mean, the night times were not predictable for me. I was probably going to drink. And then I was going to be driving in snow. And right. I thought, this is the recipe for disaster. So out of pure fear, I got myself into the start of the journey. But, you know, commit to being honest. Develop a laser-focused reason that you want to do this, because here's the problem. As soon as you start not partaking of your substance of choice, that thing that's been boosting your dopamine, you're going to experience some negative effects. I mean, if you catch it early, and this is why I want people to read my book, even when they don't have a lot of problems, start to recognize you're heading down that spectrum of severity and take care of it while it's easy before you have major symptoms of withdrawal. But if you focus on that why, be honest, and then be willing to feel the discomfort. Right? Be willing to feel that pain, because so many of us, I think, use substances or behaviors to not feel. We don't want to feel that pain. And so we just escape, and it's just easier to escape. So that would be important. And then I think for just about anybody that's struggling, it wouldn't hurt to get into some counseling. And somebody who does addiction counseling, unless you have some major underlying thing that's just overwhelms you and is the reason you can't feel or don't want to feel. Let's say you've had major abuse, whether it was childhood physical or sexual abuse or neglect, and that's just overwhelming you and you can't deal with your life, then you need counseling specific to that as well.
You may not even know that level of abuse. You might just feel pain and anxiety. Maybe some of that happened when you were young and you repressed it, and it's yes. showing up in other ways.
Yes, absolutely. That's so, so true. I mean, my own wife's story, her main addiction ended up being opiates as a result of multiple surgeries, but it's only in the last few years. Now, she's been sober and clean and sober for over 15 years, and I would say in the last 1 to 2 years, she's made the most dramatic transformations by going and doing specific work about childhood trauma and really starting to heal on a different level. And she'd been in counseling for 15 years. And I always wondered, why don't they get somewhere? he finally got the right program. Actually, wisdomandrecovery.com was the program that helped her. The author there, Julie Valenti, wrote a really small little book that's brilliant called Knowing How, the 20 Concepts. It's a PTSD thing. But, you know, she got the tools she needed in that venue, right? So there's so many different avenues to getting the support you need and growing.
I'm writing that down myself, Knowing How book, because I have some symptoms of PTSD. They show up in weird ways, like, and my dog has it. She's a labradoodle, and they're skidded. So like a truck will come that has a loud bang, or a worker will drop something. We could be walking with the whole family and two of us jump out of our shoes, me and the dog.
Yeah. Were you in the service?
No.
I hear that story a lot from Vietnam vets, for example. They'll hear a backfire of a car and they're diving under the bushes.
I'm the same. It's unbelievable. And my family's seen this. I'll open the refrigerator and an egg will fall out of the top shelf the second I open it. No notice. And it's flying in the air. And I put my hand out and catch the egg. It's the scariest fast, but it's a PTSD quick response.
Quick reflex. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't want to attribute it to my athleticism. I'm so noise and other things.
Sensitive.
And you don't, but, yeah. And I've done therapy and I think therapy is great for everybody, even if you're not an addict, because first of all, if you're running a business or you have kids or you hire someone, you get a trained professional to discuss it. And it's invaluable. Just everything is invaluable to understand the dynamics, but also yourself and your reactions. And so I that's a plug. One thing, though, you say to catch yourself early, and I understand that, but it still requires, maybe it's your prefrontal cortex, your rational decision-making to catch your addiction. Your addiction saying more, 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 relieve pain, dopamine, help, right. Subconsciously, maybe even consciously. But now you've got to override it with a command function from a more super brain. But that's hard. A lot of us, that's not developed, or we lie to ourselves all the time. We don't know we lie to ourselves. You know, I'll do that tomorrow, not today. How do you get that executive function to overpower that impulse?
Well, you know, it's waking up to the fact that you can have a better life. And I think we can all have a better life, but how? Right? So how does one go about that? Well, you've got to become aware that there are things you can do. Little things, just little things like eating better, you know, taking vitamin D, making sure you're getting better sleep. Now, these sound like ridiculous, simple lifestyle things. They're simple, but they're not easy. It is not easy to eat healthy, right? I mean, it's easy to take vitamin D. That one's easy. It's not easy to get enough sleep if you're a high stressed, you know, very always on type person. It's hard to turn that brain down, but it's worth working on it. And so these lifestyle factors I talk about in the book, I think are really key to your overall health in more than just addiction. I mean, in this book, I'm focusing on addiction, but these same things would help you if you were struggling with chronic anything, inflammation, cancer, or just trying to prevent cancer, having a less risk of that. All the neurodevelopmental things, ADD, anxiety, depression, all those chronic things will be improved and will benefit from these same lifestyle things I talk about in this book.
Well, it's a more functional medicine approach where you're looking at the whole body and you write the mind and the body, which is interesting because this functional integrative medicine approach is and with starting with food as medicine and body movement and sleep and stress, it's starting to be the cure. It sounds like even helping for addiction as well as Alzheimer's and gut issues. And
you got it. It's so important. And I think what do they say? If you put a frog in a water and turn it up slowly, the frog won't jump out. Or is that a crab? But if you put it in hot water, it jumps right out. Well, we're just slowly being boiled like those frogs, and we're not aware of the fact that we are just giving up so much of our health to these lifestyle changes that we're not even aware of. So yeah, very important.
So thank you, Dr. Paul, for your for the podcast, this honest discussion. You're fabulous and important. Book, The Addiction Spectrum. I hope this resonates with everyone. If it isn't at first resonating and you're dismissing it, please look deeper at yourself, at your kids with their phones, at our loved ones, and look at your sleep and these other issues. We need it. And then also this community idea of transparently talking about it. You've shared your alcoholism and about your wife. We all have that, and we hide. And that's why some folks get so depressed they kill themselves.
Yeah, I want your listeners to know it's never too late. It's never too early to implement a wellness plan. And it's not weak character that causes these problems. You just got to embrace the fact that you can change your life journey, right? We ultimately are responsible for our own life journey. Sure, we have a public health crisis, but don't wait for the system to solve this problem. Grab hold of your own life, be empowered, and I wish you all the success as you grasp your own journey and get healthy.
And ask for help.
Absolutely. Don't try to do this alone. It's okay to start alone, get the book, and just start the journey of making small steps. I mean, that's every little step in the right direction can move you towards the mild end of the addiction spectrum. But if you're in crisis, please ask for help. You don't need to be one of the statistics. If you're in a severe addiction, do whatever it takes. I mean, last resort, walk into an emergency room. Just don't feel like you're all alone, because honestly, every time I'm with a group of alcoholics or addicts, it's amazing how we all realize we are the lucky ones because we found each other. So you're not alone. You just got to come find us.
You've been listening to Regen 360 with your host, David Gottfried. This podcast is sponsored by BuildMove.com. Do you have what it takes to be a movement builder? Take our quiz at buildmove.com/quiz.